290.1 FM, KPFT, Houston.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found discretion is advised.
Fellow stargazers, this is not Jack Horkheimer or the Star Hustler.
What?
The Star Hustler. You know who that is, right, Groovehouse?
Yes.
Okay. Make sure that you're up on your outdated cultural references.
Astronomy cultural references.
I know Jamie's probably rolling over in her grave. Right?
No, she didn't know who it was.
Really?
Yeah, she
She's
didn't.
A fake astronomer.
She didn't know.
Oh, that's
I was
who
shocked.
Would win in a fight? The Star Hustler or Neil deGrasse Tyson?
Tyson
in a round!
Big guy.
It's my opinion, you know, if it's a clean fight, Tyson. But if it's prison rules, Horkheimer.
All right, welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's
Groovehouse.
So we got
the Skype thing figured out.
Yeah, we got
out.
The Skype thing figured out by bringing Pete all the way to Houston from San Antonio.
Yeah, it might be better than...
So we
it's just the way he talks.
And Dwight is
what's his deal?
Dwight, here... So, yeah, Dwight is out. I guess he's not feeling very well.
He's feigning ill.
He thought it was a fundraiser or something.
He had a Groupon.
Yeah, oh, he had a Groupon.
I have a Groupon. I can't make it tonight.
So that's all right. It's the first show of 2013.
That
Living
is.
On borrowed time. I don't know what to say about that.
For sure.
Yes, we're all busily looking for a new civilization that had some kind of calendar that ends in the future so we can pretend that they had some kind of insight.
The History Channel has got their R&D people working fervently to find the next apocalypse.
Some other random dirt farmer who had no insight about anything else, but we think that this time maybe he was right. He was wrong about everything else we found.
We found this clay tablet in a field in Iowa.
2013 is going to be shark year, for lack of anything else.
Yeah.
When is the Julian calendar in? See, that's a problem. You need a calendar that ends.
I do know on the ending.
My 2012 thing, calendar came to an abrupt stop last week.
On the ending thing, and I have only like had the sort of passing, you know, seen references to it kind of thing. There's that deal with there's some kind of like set of like quatrains or poems about the popes, and that's supposed to be uncanny that some guy wrote a while back. And after the current guy, there's only one, or else this is the last one. And so there's that. We're going to run out of popes. That might be, you know, you could maybe spin that into something, but
I don't know. I'm not going to get my hopes up on another end of the world thing. I don't know how many apocalypses I've survived now.
I'm banking it all on the Georgia, what's the Georgia something stones?
Oh, yeah.
The ones that like kind of Freemason knockoffs.
The half circle of.
It's got all this knowledge on it.
Yeah, it's got all these like different, like when the sun's at the equinox, it shines a certain thing. And
it's got these rules written in like 8 languages, kind of like to keep the Earth's population at.
Yeah, like limit the Earth's population.
To 500 million or something like that.
Well, I understand there was an article that just came out that said that Galveston's sinking into the ocean faster than they thought it was.
Is it sinking or is the ocean rising?
Well, yes.
I'm depressed now.
Well,
it's all doom and gloom for 2013.
It's been doom and gloom as long as I can remember. Remember the bicentennial? No. We all thought the end of the world was coming.
Maybe that's just an inconvenient truth.
you know, some of us, I guess the older end of the show spectrum, people who lived through the 70s, that was like apocalypse from January 1, 1970 all the way till 1980. And so maybe that's why
we didn't have
blasé about it.
We didn't have no man, bear, pig back then.
We had Reagan. Oh.
Like California had Reagan in the 70s.
That's true. We had Nixon. But no, I mean, it was just perpetual apocalypse.
Yeah,
and half the movies, science fiction, if you look at a lot of the science fiction then, was all this depressing, you know, civilization's going to fall.
He had a whole lot of, like, you know, nuclear Holocaust scare. Then.
Yeah, the Cold War, I sure didn't make things so happy warm.
Or do you remember, some of you, they probably kept showing it, but there was, like, this this one movie they, like, tended to show it in, like, science class, and where this guy has basically got... it's a dystopia out there, and this guy has a big greenhouse, and it's full of all these beautiful plants, and he takes care of it. No, he takes care of it. And then at the end, there's like the massive crowd of idiots outside, and they're like tapping on the glass, and they basically break the glass into the greenhouse, and so it's all destroyed. So it's like the last bit of real life on Earth, and the crowd comes through and just wrecks it. It's like indie music, you know? And that they show you in science class.
That greenhouse is totally not cool
anymore. So it's kind of like, so if you really work hard and scrape together the last plants on Earth and, you know, take care of them and have a greenhouse for them, then some group of yahoos is going to come by and destroy it. That's the 70s. Put on your bell bottoms and head out, you know.
And we called that disco. All right. Well, you can visit us online at geekradio.com. You can also hang out with us IRC, irc.cuckoo.com in the channel Tech Bites. You can use your favorite IRC client to join irc.cuckoo.com, or you can go to the website and use the Java client to join in that way. And let's see. Phone number is 713-526-5738. We'll be taking calls a little bit later in the show. But first, we're going to go to San Antonio, find out that Pete's not there, and come back to the studios for the Technology Bites Info Shot. Take it away, Info Shot.
It's the Technology Bites Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
Well, obviously, not a lot of new stuff. You know, nobody released new products between Christmas and New Year's, although maybe at some point in that news vacuum that might make sense, but I don't see how. The thing that did happen, though, is people who got devices for Christmas downloaded apps, and the records were totally smashed. In 1 week, 1.76 billion apps were downloaded. That is half a billion more than last year's week. So we're not talking about, this isn't one of those, yes, a 0.7% increase year over year. No, this is like, wham. So, you know, of course, the plus side of that is I wonder how many of those were free. But yeah, the last week of 2012, a record-breaking 1.76 billion apps were downloaded to both. This is all apps. This isn't just iOS or Android. It's both kinds of devices, according to a report from Flurry Analytics. Other records, most device activations and app downloads in a single day. Flurry estimates that at least 17.4 million iOS and Android devices were activated on Christmas Day, while 328 million apps were downloaded among both mobile platforms. To top that off, more than 50 million iOS and Android devices were activated between Christmas and New Year's, although it wasn't clear whether these were, you know, tablet or smartphone or both. All in all, app downloads increased by 65%. Compared to early December, and broke last year's record. Flurry posits that this may very well set the precedent for app downloads for this year. The way they got their data is from analysis it gathered on more than 260,000 apps available in the iTunes App Store and Google Play Store. All that data is then cross-referenced against figures released by Apple and Google to help round out the final numbers. The company claims it can detect more than 90% of devices activated each day. Makes no mention of whether or not the numbers include downloads from the Windows Phone Marketplace or BlackBerry App World. Oh, well, so I'll update it for you. I'll include Windows Phone Marketplace and BlackBerry App World. It said that there were 1.76 billion in 1 week. Okay, maybe there was 1.765 billion. 0.05 of a billion to round out for the Windows Phone and the friggin' BlackBerry. I don't know that they measure enough to matter. Yeah, so now I'm an Android and iOS fanboy, at least versus Windows Phone and BlackBerry App World. And well, why not? You gotta have some and rumors are rumors. According to Apple Insider, Apple is said to be planning to offer customers more choices when it launches the next generation iPhone, including multiple colors and sizes, with an earlier than expected debut in the May-June timeframe. I wonder when it's gonna, you know, of course it'll make sense by the end of the year, obviously, what Apple's, how they've changed it, you know, because it used to be that it was every year, and now it's kind of like, whenever they have an event and have some stuff, you know, then they announce different things. Let's see, the analyst Brian White of Topeka Capital Markets. Oh, so he's in Topeka, baby. So that would explain why he has time to make up rumors. Sent a note to investors Wednesday that his checks within the industry have indicated the so-called iPhone 5S. There's a good guess, given that there's been the 3G, 3GS, 4S. Anyways, we'll come in a variety of colors beyond the current black and white. I expect the next iPhone will be available in a total of 8 colors. He actually guessed the colors, but you can look that up if you want to find out. So he guesses the 8 colors and a red model with proceeds benefiting AIDS research. Beyond the new colors, White also said his industry checks found that a new model could become available in multiple screen sizes, so that it'd be a 4-inch iPhone 5 alongside the 3.5-inch iPhone 4S, or that right now they're doing that, but that maybe they will, as the 4S drops off, that they would have a smaller screened 5 model that would, that one I think I call. I don't think Apple is going to stand up a separate production line to have a different size. The iPhone 5 is not that radically different in profile than the iPhone 4S, so I don't see why they would do it. But, you know, I'm not an analyst spreading rumors on the internet. I'm just doing it by the radio. And I also tell you what I'm, where it's me and what somebody else said. The possibility does offer Apple the opportunity to, build a larger handset, so they could do, you know, the big 5.5-inch screen like the Galaxy Note series, the phablet. They could get into phablet territory. So we'll see. But, you know, of course, there all the, like, really obvious rumors have already been taken, so I'm guessing that leaves the really nutty bozo rumors. They'll come later. Usually early is when you get the crazy, oh, the new iPhone will be in 3 pieces, and one will go over each eye, and the other one will go in your back pocket, or, yeah. you can use that if you want. I'll know where it came from, but you know, you can put that on the internet and use it. And now in the just let's all whine at each other online thing, some of these are just fun. When big companies do it, it's particularly amusing. Microsoft says that Google has blocked YouTube search. Google and Microsoft's competition in the search market has resulted in Google blocking phones running Microsoft Windows Phone platform from operating properly with Google-owned YouTube, according to Microsoft representatives. The allegation came today as part of a larger explanation of Microsoft's ongoing effort to encourage regulators to take action against Google for anti-competitive actions. Hey, I wonder who's going to be the first guy from Microsoft that says, we know anti-competitive and we're seeing it right over there. We're the world's experts in anti-competitive and we know they're doing it to us. According to Microsoft, Google executives have told YouTube personnel, quote, not to enable a first-class YouTube experience on Windows phones. I don't know. That doesn't sound... Google's... what's their slogan? Don't be evil? That doesn't sound like... Maybe they just think that's a little naughty so that they can bend it with that on the YouTube thing. And then finally, this one's a little different. You know, like there's not new products to announce. Like I said, CES is coming, and you know, it's not a great sign when you're coming up on CES and there haven't been any really great like leaks of anything particularly interesting that's exciting. You know, wow, everybody's looking for it. And there haven't even been, like, rumors of anything that's particularly exciting. So that's not a great sign. And I don't know. It doesn't sound like Apple is really poised. For Macworld, they're not going to make any announcements in January. So, of course, the nutty rumor mill is just silent, and I don't get it. So that with that in mind, there was an article at Gadget Lab on Wired. And I strongly recommend, especially if you're geeky, that you read it. It's by Kevin Kelly, who, you know, he was with, like, Whole Earth Catalog and some of that kind of stuff. Big on technology, big on the futurism kind of stuff. The subhead, it's called Better Than Human, and it's talking about the influx of robotics. Because that's been quietly going along. I mean, Roomba is robotics. The idea is what he's saying is that it's not like iRobot, not the company that makes Roombas, but the horrible movie with Will Smith. That they're not going to all be. It's not going to be like androids walking around that you know that look like us, at least for a while. But he says, imagine that 7 out of 10 working Americans got fired tomorrow. What would they all do? Apparently they would destroy the robots because that would be the... but he says it's hard to believe that you'd have an economy at all if you gave pink slips to more than half the labor force, but that in slow motion is what the Industrial Revolution did to the workforce of the early 19th century. So what he says in the article is, you know, in quick summation, is that... the coming robotics revolution or that the ongoing robotics revolution is going to be like the Industrial Revolution was, which is that before everybody was working on farms and the automation that, you know, now we're down to where 1% of the people, 1% of the farm jobs that used to be there are gone. Now they're not, but they've been replaced by tractors and combines and, you know, machines that do the work instead. And that those people didn't go idle. You know, they didn't, there aren't just millions of people sitting around America's farms. You know, we don't have anything to do, no jobs. But he argues that then it will be analogous when the robots come in. It may be hard to believe, but before the end of this century, 70% of today's occupations will likewise be replaced by automation. He says, yes, dear reader, even you will have your job taken away by machines. In other words, robot replacement is just a matter of time. This upheaval is being led by a second wave of automation, one that is centered on artificial cognition, cheap sensors, machine learning, and distributed smarts. He says this will touch all jobs from manual labor to knowledge work. First, machines will consolidate their gains in already automated industries. So basically saying that they'll... finish replacing assembly line workers and then replace the workers in the warehouses. Fruits and vegetable picking to be roboticized. Pharmacies featuring a single pill dispensing robot in the back while the pharmacists focus on patient consulting. Next, the more dexterous chores of cleaning in offices and schools will be taken over by late night robots, starting with easy to do floors and windows and eventually getting to toilets. Talking about the highway legs of long haul trucking being driven by robots embedded in truck cabs. That's not a big step. Then it hits the part that obviously hits home to a lot more people. I mean, it's just that list covered a lot of workers, but then he talks about it going into white collar work. And, you know, he said, we already have artificial intelligence in many of our machines. We just don't call it that. He says there's a piece of software by a company called Narrative Science that can write newspaper stories about sports games directly from the stats or generate a synopsis of a company's stock performance each day from bits of text around the web. Or if you think about it, you know, one of the things he says, if you think about it, Google, you couldn't have human beings do that job. In other words, no matter how many, you know, print out all the paper or how many computers you had sitting around to just look at, just to do the looking at the pages, you couldn't, like, you couldn't have a group of people sitting around and the phone rings or even over electronically the request comes in, you know, I need to know about this obscure subject and where somebody would be able to find it. So, in a sense, I guess it's sort of knowledge automation. And he points out there's the guy who did Roomba has a new company, and he has a new robot called Baxter. And Baxter looks more like a person, but it would not be mistaken for one. It's basically sort of two arms and a monitor above it, and then it sits on wheels. And the idea is that it's a robot you can roll up to the line or roll up to a place, and it can be alongside people, and it has sensors. So if a person gets near it, it will stop, you know, or it won't do things. It won't hurt them. He doesn't say anything about the three laws of robotics. But apparently the way this thing works is you take it and you don't have to code it. The big thing on the big industrial bots, part of why they're, and he talks about this in the article, part of why they're all, they like, the humans and the bots have to be separate. You know, if you go look, there's a big, you know, there's chain link around that stuff because the machine doesn't know that people are there. So it just does, you know, it churns out its thing, and if you put your hand in the way, it'll take that too. Where this, you take, and you have to code it, and most of the expense on the big ones apparently is the software. Because if you want to change something, you have to shut it down. But this Baxter, you teach it by, you take it through the steps so that even a person who, basically a person who was illiterate, could teach this thing to do tasks. And Baxter's $26,000. Well, that starts getting, we're starting to hit the Moore's Law point, I think, is part of what he's saying. You grab its arms and guide them in the correct motions and sequence to show it. Baxter learns a procedure and then repeats it. So,
merge with the robots that do repeating procedures.
Well, it means you can show it, but you can reprogram it like that, you know, and you can have any person. Wow, some things, unfortunately, radio doesn't show you everything. Oh, wait, no, Baxter.
Unfortunately,
Baxter is $22,000. So, the thing he basically says is that, that how robot replacement will happen is that there's four categories. Under existing jobs and new jobs. Existing jobs, there's jobs today that humans do that machines will do eventually do better. And then the B category is currently jobs that humans can't do but the machines can. And one of the examples, to just give a real basic one, is like weaving cotton. A machine can just like crank out miles of cotton, you know, woven cotton fabric in a day. Where the only people, unless you really want that human touch with the flaws and the, you know, and takes a lot longer and so on, that's the only, you would only buy it because you were insisting on
handmade.
Those flaws and handmade. And then under the new jobs, he says there'll be jobs that only humans will be able to do at first. And then the last category is robot jobs that we can't even imagine yet. And so, you know, you wonder, I guess, because I've said it for a long time, the, you know, what happens in the job market when the first, you know, burger flipping robot is there? You know, I mean, so everybody's first teenage job, or usually most kids' early teenage job, is going to work at McDonald's or, you know, fast food.
Well, there goes my job.
And, the bot shows up all the time and, you know, doesn't...
Yeah, you don't have to pay insurance on it.
It doesn't sulk. But
it doesn't
then,
call in sick. It doesn't lip off to the customers.
The part, I would like to be optimistic like Kevin Kelly, but the, one of the things just to say, you know, he says basically, yeah, the Industrial Revolution happened. A lot of things got, a lot of jobs went away, and then brand new jobs appeared. You know, in the last, you know, think about it, in the last 30 or 40 years, jobs like web developer and a lot of computer programming jobs, video game developers, that came along and are brand new. The thing is, though, they replace, they don't come along in the kinds of millions and millions of jobs that, you know, that are we're looking at displacing. Because you think about it, if they start doing white-collar jobs, if robots start replacing white-collar jobs... How many new white collar jobs do you need? You know, you've got the, if you
what
look
mean
at
white collar jobs,
Walmart,
are you going to have like robotic CEOs?
If you think about it, well, I would bet not. That would be the last one that they would replace, right? Because the guy who's running the company while all the machines do all the work.
Well, I mean, like obviously, machines aren't going to sell your product necessarily. They'll dispense it if you already know what you want. But in terms of generating revenue for a company, you're going to go out and sell your product. You're going to have people that are going to do that because people are your consumers. So you have to think about in terms of, yes, manual.
Well, yeah, white collar
to me doesn't strike me. I mean, I'm thinking blue collar. I'm thinking like we're talking about having robots that will go in, tear up a stretch of freeway, and then pave it a new set, runs 24/7, rain or shine, goes out and does it. Those are the kind of jobs that you're talking about replacing, I think, still.
I think, yeah. One of the things he says is the things where you have to make a decision, where there's a human decision, those would stay. But if you think about, say, the model on selling stuff, if you think about retail, though, if the robots stock the shelves and you have, the pay from your phone, the NFC stuff, and all that, how many people do you need in the store?
Well, that you're talking about, I don't think that's a robot thing. I think that there will be a robot component, but already going to the store and buying something is becoming less and less of an issue. I mean, people buy their stuff online. So you have big warehouses like Amazon or whatever, they're going to have robot pickers, and you're going to have all the product there, and you're going to be able to go online and buy your computer, or have it made to spec by a robot. I can totally see that.
Or I guess if you have the foresight to invest in some of these, you know, think about if you're starting a business, I guess instead of having to do a big manufacturing startup thing for yourself, if you came up with a new product, then feasibly you could get the raw materials and get a set of robots to do the work to assemble your thing, your widget, or whatever, your product in your garage.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you can show this $22,000 robot how to do stuff just by stepping it through, you could make it make your little homemade things or whatever, presumably. The optimist is that, you know, maybe this will free us all up to do more interesting things. But then on the other side, it's kind of like, what do you do for a wage? How is that affected when, like programming, think about it. If computers keep advancing sufficiently, at a certain point, you're going to hit where, for a lot of solutions, a rack full of computers could run through and optimize code or generate code from snippets that already exist that would do the task that I program, Barrett does, that could generate it faster, better, you know, more optimal, no mistakes.
Not hard to do.
Yeah, really. We set the bar low with Barrett and I, but...
Well, I think part of it, too, is you know, in a... we're going to sound like something other than a computer show here in a minute if we're not careful. But in a capitalist society like we live here, the idea is that you make a product and you take it to market and you make as much money as you possibly can off of it. So there's the thought is, in my mind, is that robotics make the cost of manufacture go down. So conceivably, you know, it's going to be just come down to raw materials. How much raw material so it takes to make that car, if it can be completely automated, I mean, every step, like building the engine, everything. You know, I can produce a car, I just push this button, and it poops out a car. I have a laser printer, or I have a 3D prints my a BMW. So when do you see that, you know, that obviously there's going to be a high expense to get those robots to do that at first. If you're going to talk about replacing your workforce with robots, I just can't believe that sentence came out of my mouth. But if you replace your workforce with robots, there's a capital investment. So there's no savings that come down to the consumer at that point. The savings are going to first be to the producer, to the person who's making the widget. So how fast that happens will determine what the workforce needs to be. I mean, how much revenue do you have to have? What kind of revenue stream do you have if everything's really cheap to buy and can get it? So you're talking about hopefully not just advances in robotics, but advances in synthesis and being able to synthesize raw materials and create stuff. So,
It's one thing that's interesting with it that turns it around, you know, from to take the not doom and gloom approach, is if you think about it, the U.S., there's all the people who bemoan manufacturing moving offshore. You bring in a bunch of robots that don't cost that much more, and at some point they become competitive with offshoring, and suddenly that stuff gets manufactured locally again. And in a sense, so either we're either like setting ourselves up to where we can't function without, you know, the support of this cheap labor or all that stuff, or we're just farther along the curve, and when it changes, we've already lost the jobs that were going to be replaced by the initial wave of this stuff.
Well, that's what a lot of people are hoping is going to turn American manufacturing around, is the ability for us to go and, you know, quickly automate processes, you know, and build things very quickly, fabricate things very quickly, you know, on demand, you know, and that'll put us back ahead of, you know, people doing it by hand in very impoverished countries.
Yeah.
Know, so that's...
So, I mean, there's the upside of that as things get more complex, but it's still, you just, like I said, the programming one, when you start thinking about a lot of websites, if you look at it, at some point somebody's going to write the program that can generate websites, can generate the basic code that does a website from a Photoshop thing. If you look, I don't know, I follow that stuff. I'm into content management systems, and there are some, they don't live up to the promise, I'll just say that, but that look very, that are very close to where, you know, anybody, grandma could go and sort of click and drag a space to put the text in that spot on the website kind of thing. So if they know enough to have consumed websites, they would be able to create content into one and manage it and save it and move it around or make it look like what they want.
Like front page.
No, this is way... it's way past... That was the initial attempts.
Yeah.
But they've kept going. I mean, there's a lot more stuff. Now there's a jQuery plugin that lets you turn pieces of content on the page where they're just editable right there in the browser. And if they have where you authenticate, obviously you don't want it where anybody who comes by can click and edit the content in your
blink tags.
But
Wikipedia.
But you can click on if you're logged in, you click on it, you make your changes right in the page, WYSIWYG in the page, and then you hit a check mark and it uses AJAX to update the content in the database. starts changing it a whole lot. You know, it doesn't take much farther than to, if you have better automation on the back end to where it generates how many different variations on the website to for you to choose from to be the one that's perfect for you or whatever. I mean, obviously you're not going to, a good designer with good insight as far as the appearance I would think that's going to be that would be one of the last things to go. But a just grunt coder who's just cranking out HTML pages that have that connect up to a database and display content, you know, the farther out you go, I think the more vulnerable that looks.
See, I think if you make robots code web pages, that's when they're going to uprise and they're going to take over us, and it's going to be all over at that point.
Which is why we also need to invest in the apes so that then they're available to help be on our side, or else we all die in the crossfire between the robot ape war.
Robots versus apes.
Somebody was saying there was one of the Planet of the Apes movies where the humans and the apes like got along, like one of the later ones.
Well, there was or was it that beneath the Planet of the Apes, or
the one where they found the nuclear silo?
Where they were worshipping the nuclear bomb?
I don't know.
There was, after a certain point with them, when Charlton Heston stopped reliably appearing in them, they got a lot more vague on the. They started seeming like weekly episodes of Star Trek, the original show, you know? Can Lieutenant Jones assemble a rudimentary gun while being chased by these apes around this island?
There's a Planet of the Apes clip called, Can't We All Just Get Along? I think that's in the vein of that. Is Fox doing a Planet of the Apes updated thing? Like a TV series?
No. I mean, they had the movies. There was the Planet of the Apes with Marky Mark. And then there was the Rise of the Planet of the Apes with James Franco. So I'm guessing they're planning to kind of continue through the movies.
Saga.
So, okay, well, the phones have not loaded up, so it's not like we're keeping
Well, we haven't given out the number much either, because there wasn't really like, and that's the
that's
news.
That's true. Oh, sorry. Sorry, I at least segued in the... Well, that's because we have not yet replaced... the news with the robotic, even if it sounds like it sometimes when Skype isn't working.
Have you scanned for spyware?
And here's the news as read by Dr. Stephen Hawking.
713-526-5738. I'm having trouble identifying
Nick's serve is down. I've thrown my known good passwords at it, so either we all got hacked or just something. Maybe they did an upgrade.
Or now somebody knows all your known good passwords.
No, I mean, I tried the two that I had written down, and
okay,
they're
definitely
not
just
working.
Me,
it's not
so it's like Nick's serve is down.
Yeah. No, it's got to be good, because he went to forgotmypassword.ru, and they'll help you with...
They tried me. I put in all the ones I knew, and then they try them all against the, you know...
They even will ask for all his logins for whatever ones he might possibly use.
That was one of the tricks people like to do when there was a Nick serve back in the day. Was whenever there was a net split, somebody would change their name to Nick serve and
grab all the identifications.
Grab passwords.
Yep. So right. It's telling you invalid password?
It's telling me invalid password, yeah. So I keep getting it. I know I didn't change my password. I've used that password. I actually went on to IRC, and you can do an info about your account on Nick server. It tells you when you registered your account. Now, I can't believe I've been registered on cuckoo.com for over 9 years. So, you know, yes, I want my account to work.
Almost over. That's over half the life of the show.
Over. All right. 713-526-5738 right now. We have Groovehouse screening calls.
Because we have not yet replaced him with the robot either.
All right.
But look at the phone systems where you call in and they... Yes, I will not put that forth as a total success, but a lot of them where you have the voice thing, where
the automation,
you say the stuff, it works fairly decently, and it should just get better. I mean, as they have more horsepower, it's going to get better.
Well, I think, you know, I'm just going to go back to the idea that, you know, as stuff gets easier to make and easier to do, it should be, the savings should be passed on, but that's not what's going to happen in this, in the society that we live in. It's just going to be increased profit for the person who's selling the product.
I think it'll come down to control of the resources and control of the designs.
You may want to read the article, think about what you think, and then think about what you think about Occupy.
Explain.
Well, if revenues in the country aren't distributed better than they are now,
right?
Then it's really easy to look at the kind of, you know, medieval serfs and barons kind of approach to which the way without getting too political on it, the way that the things are distributed now looks a whole lot like 100 years ago, as opposed to basically equality in the United States peaked out in about the 1970s, which is where the range was a lot tighter. There were a lot fewer rich people. There were more poor people, but everybody was closer to the middle. And now you have things where the you know, increase in wealth for like the top 1%, you know, that's the popular thing that you hear nowadays talked about. Since the 70s, if you look at a graph, the benefits, the vast majority of the increase in wealth in the country went to that top part. And unless you change something with that, the rest of us, unless we're part of that top 1%, are kind of screwed.
Well, I think, you know, what Barrett mentioned about who controls the design and who controls, you know, unfortunately, the creators don't have the money to push their stuff forward. So they have to get investors and they have to have people take control of that. So the people that can bankroll the good ideas.
Only the old money, the people that had money before.
So, it's perpetuating where the people that have money get more money and the people that don't have money don't have an opportunity to get more money. So, I don't know.
Obviously, it's a cool subject.
But I want to be careful because, you know, it gets dangerously close into this whole, you know, like you brought up Occupy. There are going to be people that are going to bring up the fact that, you know, people want to live in a welfare state. You know, I want to be real careful there.
Well, you know, communism, and by that I mean Marxism, I guess is a better way to put it. Karl Marx's stuff, and I'm not going into it, but
I've got a gun to his head just in case.
No, clearly, well, you think about it, that came as a reaction to the Industrial Revolution. The idea was, so part of this I would say is look at how smart people looked at it and thought, oh my gosh, look at this. These machines are replacing all these workers. At some point, there will be nothing for them to do. There will be so much leisure. And here we are 100 and some odd years later. And I guess relative to a lot of people, we have a lot of leisure, but we also, like Americans, take fewer vacations than anybody.
Yeah, but also people are spending more time at work browsing Facebook and hanging out on Twitter, too, so there's a lot more leisure time on the job.
So there's that. But, I mean, the Marx thing, the socialism thing, came out of the Industrial Revolution. Obviously, some things it's maybe an appropriate solution for and some things it's not. But they thought that was the end, you know, it was going to ruin everything for everybody.
Right.
So somewhat being patient and looking at what's going on with the robots thing, it may not turn out like.
Well, I the Roomba did not put the maid services out of business. So. All right, looks like we got a lot of calls. So we'll see if Groovehouse wants to hand one off to us. Who do we?
Oh yeah,
we got some calls on the line. Groovehouse,
yes,
you doing
do.
Your job screening them
I
calls,
doing my
getting
best.
Them all ready,
I'm,
lined
yes,
up.
I am.
All right. Well, why don't you tell us who's up first? Right.
Up first,
the first call.
First call of the year.
Wow. Do it. Yeah.
Wow. First call of the year.
A lot of responsibility. A lot of pressure on this call.
On this button push right here.
All right. Who
all
is
right,
it?
Then first call of the year. It's going to go to David.
David, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
I can't stand the pressure.
just take a deep breath. Don't breathe too hard on the phone, but that just gets into a whole other thing here.
Well, while I was on hold, I lost the computer, and my question might have went with it.
Okay.
I was standing with Malware Bites, and it pulled up three things, but what happened is I wasn't sure if I should delete these or not.
My philosophy on Malware Bytes is it is to delete anything that it finds.
PUP.ADBUNDLE. And one of them was related to Service Pack 3 XP.
Yeah, that one sounds like Universal Plug and Play. Although, I don't know, I'm not familiar with that extension. You said it was a...
Well, again, I'm just going to go back to my original statement, which is when I scan with Malware Bytes, whatever it detects as being a problem, I go ahead and let it remove it. Because I've never seen a situation where you've removed something, unless the virus took over like a system file or something, at which point you've got to fix. You know, people think that when they get hit with viruses or spyware, that it's like, it's an inconvenience. But those things do damage to your system. So even once you've cleaned the infection out, you have this like gaping wound in your operating system.
It doesn't make your computer stronger.
Right. So if you're curious about what it finds and what, you know, if you don't want to go with my advice of just having it remove what it finds, you can take what it finds and plug that into Google to research what it is.
I couldn't find anything on it.
Although, right. if it's an important system file and it's showing up to Malwarebytes as a virus and problem, I'm thinking that regardless, so having it take it out, if that means the system doesn't work, you already were working with a system that wasn't going to work.
Right.
But the only thing I found on it was one person that had the same question that I had, and then everything else pulled up was stuff related to downloading more spyware to get rid of whatever this thing was I was trying to get rid of.
Well, if you've got...
One person had a question that I had. What was it?
Well, say one more time. I'll go back on my word and say, tell me what the file is, and I'll tell you if it's okay to delete it.
Since you're the first caller of the year, yeah. You win an extra...
So what is it that it's found?
P as in puppy, U as in union, P as in puppy, dot, A as in Adam, D as in dog, B as in baby, U as in union, N like nation, D like David, L like Lincoln, E as in Edward.
Pup, A bundle.
You're infected.
Okay, it is an actual virus. It's an actual piece of spyware that needs to go away because malware told you that it found it. It thinks it's a problem. May I please remove it? You say, yes, Malwarebytes, you may remove it.
Okay, now since I was on hold, my computer shut off and I had it set up there ready to delete it. But
well, you're going to have to reboot the computer, run the scan again, and let it detect it and clean it.
Okay, then I will do just that.
Now, that being said, you know, if you've got a spyware issue, and this is really a bad precedent that the first call of the year is a spyware call, but if you've got a spyware issue, it is possible that Malwarebytes won't get it all. I mean, just because, you know, but Malwarebytes will find what it finds, and if you see that everything's running the way it should, then great, but be aware that you may have to run additional tools to get rid of an infection. If you've got a bad enough infection, and I outlined this at geekradio.com under the spywares link, you know, there are a few different tools that we recommend that you run. If you know you've got a problem, if you know you got a spyware infection, and you're still seeing symptoms of it, you may want to run more than just Malwarebytes.
Okay, yeah, that's where I got this from. I'll try those other two that you had on there.
Yeah. So right, Malwarebytes, so reboot, rescan, try to get rid of it, and good luck to you.
All right, thanks.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there are so many different kinds of viruses and malware packages out there that I don't even bother trying to learn what they all are. And in my experience, and I've cleaned a lot of spyware infected computers. So in my experience, your best option when you're running a tool that has been vetted like Malwarebytes is to let it do its job. You know, it's not like you're lying awake on the operating room table and going, hey, doc.
Yeah, the surgeon isn't asking you the opinion. Hey, do you still want that?
Yeah.
Go over to the left.
You know.
By your kidney.
No, just think of it, you're going under, and you're going to wake up, and hopefully that thing's going to be out of your computer. So 713-526-573. But if you're curious, like we did a Google search on pup.abundle, and they talk about what it is and, you know, that it's, you know, it's a problem. It's apparently part of Super Anti, might be one of the fake anti-spyware tools, but...
Yeah, that's the thing. Someone did Pete, you might know about this. Someone ran all the different antivirus packages, you know, kind of through the grist mill to find out what the hit rates were on new viruses and new malware packages. They had less than a 5% detection rate. So pretty much anything that's new, it's getting by. So what that tells us is these guys that are, you know, writing the antivirus packages, they're working off known things that have been found in the wild. They're not using some kind of, you know, software package that's going to predict, hey, this is spyware, let's move it. So by the virtue of it saying, hey, we found this, we want to take it off there, chances are someone, a real person, not a robot, has gone and said, hey, you know, this is bad. You can go ahead and take it off. So it's not just going to falsely identify a system file and crash your system by removing it.
Right. I mean, the only time that I've seen where system files or valid system files get removed by spyware anti-spyware programs is when the system file has been either corrupted by the spyware or replaced. Like you, like you'll have a an executable file or a DLL file that'll just, because that's one of the ways that spyware tries to sneak its way in, is it disguises itself as something legitimate and necessary. And I've run into many occasions where, because of the way that spyware redirects your internet traffic, for example, when you remove the spyware, you're no longer able to access the internet because it replaced all of your internet accessing software with its own stuff, which was malicious. And then by removing it, you no longer had that gateway to the internet.
Say it's like a system file, right? And you're saying, but I don't want to cut my arm off. But unfortunately, your arm has already been replaced by a tentacle.
Yeah.
So,
well, and
so your arm's already gone.
The scanning software, you know, a little bit about how it works without going super deep, but enough for the just average user to understand. When it goes through, it's not just like looking for file names. When it tells you the file name that it's going to remove, that's because it found code inside that file that matches patterns that are spyware.
It's usually some kind of heuristic matching is file size, file type, any strings in the file, so different things.
And I would bet the strings is the main place where they're detecting this stuff, because obviously it has to have the right code in the right place to do the trick, to make the malware thing happen. And so when it finds a match, then if that file's got it, it's done. You know, it's not the file you remember. It's not the the upnp.dll that you loved so well.
This isn't your dear great aunt anymore.
It's a pod person, and you need to kill it with fire.
All right, 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air with us tonight. Who's up next, Groovehouse?
All right, up next, we're going to speak with John.
John, you're on the air with Technology. That night.
Okay. Good evening.
Good evening.
I've just upgraded from Windows XP to Windows 7.
Okay.
And with what I'm wanting to do with what I did with XP is I'm wanting to disable the autoplay and auto run just for USB attached devices, so that when I attach a USB device, the computer will identify it, load any drivers if necessary, you know, like a thumb drive or a hard drive or what have you. And these are storage devices most often there, but that it'll see it, but not try to identify files on it or try to run anything. With XP, I was able to use TweakUI 2.1, and it actually had a little option in the menu to say, okay, disable.
Yeah, you know, all that TweakUI did was give you kind of a centralized access to certain features of the operating system.
Right.
So there's a native way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a native way to disable the auto run, and I haven't done it in Windows 7, but there's a native way to do that, and I believe it has to do with when you right click on, let's see, have you done any research on this whatsoever?
I've done a little bit, and a lot of the Microsoft TechNet conversations usually end up saying, go to the control panel, all control panel items, autoplay, and just uncheck the use autoplay for all media and devices. I'm kind of going, that doesn't do what I'm wanting it to do, really.
All right, I'm doing a little research here. There's ways to do it, I believe, just for the USB, but I, honest to goodness, I've not. Isn't there an option, like when the autoplay pops up, when you stick it in the Windows computer, and then it gives you an option that tells you what you want it to do anytime this kind of device is connected, and you can, and one of the options is do nothing?
Yes. The thing that I'm having is, like, I'll hook in a USB hard drive, and it'll do that, and I'll say, don't do anything. I'll disconnect, and then in the same USB port, go ahead and connect a thumb drive, and it'll do the same thing, and then I'll disconnect the thumb drive and attach the hard drive, and it'll go through the same Hi there. What do you want me to do?
All right. Let's see. Autoplay will no longer support the auto run functionality for non-optical. Blah blah blah. Example autoplay. I'd have to do a little bit more research. Did you find?
I mean, there is. It looks like they changed it up due to security issues in Windows 7. If you're comfortable getting behind a registry editor, which may or may not be a good idea, there's a key called No Drive Type Auto Run, and you can go in there and change that to where nothing will go on auto run.
Well, he just wants USB.
Yeah, but I don't know. It's an all or nothing kind of deal.
Well, there is a turn off auto play in Windows 7. If you go to, click on, do you have the computer on it in front of you? None of us have Windows 7.
Yes, I do. I have it up in front of me.
Start and then run, or start and then in the search box type autoplay.
Okay.
And tell me if you get a screen that comes up for that.
And if I could just type the word autoplay correctly, that'd be great.
Because, you can at least, it looks like you can turn off the autoplay feature on... Possibly on all drives or on just the CD, ROM, and removable media drives.
I bet that's touching into this Windows key because there are four different values you can set, and some of it's free enabled.
I suggest RegEdit as the... I mean, if this guy can't get on Google and find the answer to a Windows 7 question, I don't want him editing his registry.
Yeah, I was comfortable in XP because I played with it until... I broke it a lot.
Well, there's a website called sevenforums.com, sevenforums.com, that has an article on it, and it's the autoplay enable and disable. But if you can get your computer to work and you can type something for me, I might be able to get you there.
Okay. Let's see. I did the search, and it says control panel 4 items. Let's see, autoplay is one.
Right.
Start or stop using autoplay for all media devices, or all media and devices. Next item is change default settings for media or devices.
That's what you're looking for, right?
And then place other media.
I believe you're in the right area where you're going to be able to do it.
Okay. I also have the autoplay.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know for sure which settings you're going to want to mess with, but this is where computer ownership gets to be fun, and you get to look around in there. And,
okay.
But it should, there's a setting in there, and you should be able to logic it out from taking a look at what's in there that will allow you to turn off the autoplay. Because if you go from enabled to disabled or not configured, and you can tell it how you want it to respond to all drives or just the CD-ROM and removable drives, I believe is the drop down on there.
Yeah, that's.
Okay, well, listen, we gotta let you go because we're going to the top of the hour. But, you can always email me, jay@geekradio.com, or use the contact form on the website to pose your question, and I'll help you dig into it a little bit further. All right, well, we are going to get ready to do our break and get out of here. We'll be back after these messages. You're listening to Technology Bites.
World Voices Houston announces auditions for its Spring 2013 season. Conducted by Dr. Eric Esparza, World Voices Houston is one of the newest choral groups in Houston. Singing music from cultures around the world, the group is open to adult singers from diverse cultural backgrounds. World Voices Houston rehearses at St. Mark's United Methodist Church in the Heights. Please contact Dr. Eric Esparza at 713-364-2614 for audition information. This is KPFT Houston.
KPFT is sponsored in part by the Houston Arts Alliance Folklife and Traditional Arts Program. The Folklife Program is celebrating devotional music from diverse faith communities based in Houston with a special concert that includes Nigerian praise music, Sufi songs, Sikh kirtans, Vietnamese choral music, and Indian Carnatic ragas. January 19th and 20th at Asia Society Texas Center, free with reservation. For more info, visit HoustonArtsAlliance.com.
And we are back.
with more Technology Bites.
Do we?
Yes, we do. Do it. Do it!
Hey, Barrett. What's happening?
I don't know.
Well, room around town.
We interrupt this skit to bring you...
Yeah. That means it's time for... Yeah. Anyway. Take it away, Barrett.
All right. Happy New Year, everyone. We're back with a full year of geeky goings-on here in Houston. I'll try to cover the first few tonight. If going to a geek gathering was your New Year's resolution, you're in luck, as this Friday is the New Year's edition of the Technology Bites Geek Gathering. We'll be meeting at Cone's Wine, Darts, Coffee and Art, Coffee House / Bar in Midtown Houston. 2808 Mile at Drew is where you'll want to be shortly after 7 o'clock this Friday, January 4th. Cons has coffee, beer, wine, and free Wi-Fi, but no food aside from a selection of chips. Outside food is fine, though, so you're free to source a pizza from a local shop if the need should arise. Also, welcome are any new gadgets you may have picked up since we last saw you. We'll also be having a short gathering within the gathering to talk about holding down a table at the Houston Mini Maker Fair. If you wanted to attend in years past, you've had to travel either to San Mateo outside San Francisco or New York City. This time it's happening in your own backyard. Of course, the Houston Mini Maker Fair is happening January 19th at the Stafford Center. Existing for one day only, the event promises to introduce Houston to hundreds of cool new ideas as put forth by some of our own citizenry. Fully functional remote control subs, some up to 4 feet in length, will be present, as will an internationally recognized maker in the Lego modeling field, Jared Burks. Jared specializes in mini figurine customization accessories and uses both new and traditional techniques to outfit Lego figurines for activities as diverse as zombies, zombie hunting, Spartan warriors, and an entire universe of Star Wars characters. And if you're not content building Lego scenes in which forces clash, you may be interested in Nerf gun modifications as put forth by Justin J.P. Roth. Not to be content with a working radius of a few dozen feet, J.P. can modify a stock blaster to fire a Nerf dart up to 100 feet and can increase that range to 150 feet by building his own darts or slugs. There's actually an entire group in Houston dedicated to modifying and building Nerf-style creations called the Houston Area Nerfers, not to be confused with the Haffrin Area Nerf Herders. And just as an aside, does anyone know what Haffrin is or what a Nerf Herder is? Not the band?
Well, the Nerf Herder thing is from Star Wars.
Yes. Haffrin, yeah. Haffrin, actually, same deal, was a planet in the Estrin sector in the Outer Rim of the Star Wars Old Republic, and a Nerf Herder was someone who herded Nerfs on various planets throughout the galaxy. It was solely an occupation for lower-class beings. The term Nerf Herder became an insult used throughout the galaxy. Nerf Herders were often somewhat simple, but as a result of living outdoors and fighting off anything that interfered with their herds, they became quite capable. And, of course, Nerfs are quadrupeds characterized by their four curved horns and shaggy coats of fur. Common Nerfs stood about 1.3 meters at the shoulders. Their mass of hair tangled easily, creating the perfect web for insects and other foreign objects to cling to, giving them a pungent odor.
Later, the term was replaced by calling them a Jar Jar.
Yeah.
Did you get that from Wikipedia?
I went to Wikipedia for most of that, yeah. You thought a Tauntaun smelled bad, yeah. So looking at
Tauntaun smelled bad on the inside.
Well, no, so Han Solo thought they smelled bad on the outside, and Princess Leia called Han Solo a Nerf Herder, I believe, at some point during the movies.
Yeah, yep. That's where it was used.
Anyway, looking after Nerfs was definitely not the best job to be had in the Old Republic. Anyway, you can find them on Facebook if you want to give them the action. The Nerfers, not the Nerf Herders. To find out more about the Maker Faire, hit www.makerfairehouston.com. That's F-A-I-R-E, Houston.com. Also happening that same day is the Houston Area Apple Users Group semi-annual swap meet. Things run from 9 until noonish, but be sure to fact-check me on that before departing to beautiful Bel Air, Texas, on the HAUG site, haaug.org. And, of course, hit geekradio.com for details and directions to this month's Geek Gathering. That's it for your first year of festivities, and that's that for Barrett time.
It's getting to the point where I'm going to have to start bringing a Windows computer back to the studio.
Just to follow along?
Just to follow along.
Did you just install, like, VirtualBox and
get Parallels?
Or something. I've been too lazy to do it. Dwight's not here to fire up his Windows machine. Yeah, who would have thought?
VirtualBox is free, and it works well. I've been using one on my desktop for the last.
Yeah, I still need a copy of Windows 7.
Yeah, I'll need a copy of Windows
7. Once I got 16 gig of memory.
Seems vulnerable to system updates, though. I think over the longer you do it, because I had it set up on an earlier, I guess, like Snow Leopard. And then in the course of going through Lion and Mountain Lion and all that stuff, it now the virtual machines don't open. And so you have to kind of, it seems like you have to redo it every so often, which then they don't really give you the kind of upgrade path like you can get with the ones you pay for.
And I think the part of the confusion on the on the auto run, it's actually called auto play in Windows 7 as opposed to auto run.
Because it's more fun that way. It's a marketing thing.
So you're not running, you're playing.
So if you actually Google search disable auto play Windows 7, there seems to be a lot more answers to how to get that to do what you want it to do. I'm trying to see if I actually wrote something on that a while back.
I just didn't think of it because it wasn't phrased, because the question wasn't phrased exactly using the terms you wanted.
Yeah, I remember there was, I mean, I've had people not ask me how to turn it off, but how to turn it on. So, let me see.
So do you just do that in reverse?
Could be, yeah. Let's see. Okay, hold on here.
So you uninstall Windows 7 from on top of itself?
Unclick start.
Click on stop, which is really means unclick start. Let's see. Because, yeah, like in 2005,
that window that's open, close
in 2005,
it.
My CD-ROM will not autoplay. That was the, yeah, I probably didn't reference that article in my brain from 7
You can just remember that?
Well, it's also XP, so it's not Windows 7. But yeah, he'll find it. I just, you know, I want to see him have success in the new year with turning off the autoplay. Although people who have enough USB devices that they plug and unplug from their computer on such a regular basis that little nick would just bother you that much that you've had to turn it off. I mean, if I plug something in and something pops up, I just click X and I close it. You know, I mean, I get that all the time with USB. It's like, because I don't do it like 10 times a day, but I know that there are people who must be walking around with Tim the Tool Man belts full of USB flash drives. You know, all right. Enough of that. Groovehouse.
Yes.
Who's up next?
Up next on the second half of the show, we're going to speak with Jelani.
Jelani, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hey, you guys, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I had a question about like a certification track that I want to go on. And I heard you guys talking about the job market and what jobs are, you know.
You should get a degree in robotics.
Polishing. I think there'll always be a job for that.
Oh, man. Yeah.
What'll happen when the robots do take over and they take all the jobs, when they turn evil and turn on mankind, the doctor robots won't be healing people. So I think medical. I think it'd be a doctor, just to hedge your bets.
A certification in doctoring robotics.
Or anti-robotics doctorology. All right, so anyway, what are you thinking you want to do?
Well, I got my A+, and I got my Network Plus, but I want to go to somewhere, like maybe like on the desktop side, certifications around like maybe the server side.
Well, there's all kinds of Microsoft certifications for learning Server 2008 and SQL. You know, there's SQL Server. There's systems administration. I don't know where I would necessarily recommend that you go get trained for that. Since you've got your A+ and your Network+, perhaps finding an entry level job doing some kind of support would get you exposed to the environment to where you could make a more reasonable decision on how to further your education.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Are you working somewhere now or?
I'm currently working right now.
In the field or in some other field?
In the field. Yeah. I'm in the field, but it's like, say, very, it's, you know, it's kind of up in the air, I don't know where, you know, because the field that I'm working in, it's like hardware. Like, we replace hardware.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
so you're more A-plus than anything else right now. You're building machines or replacing hard drives and stuff like that.
Yeah, replacing hard drives, building machines, you know, stuff like that. So I didn't know,
In terms of, like, so what are you thinking you want to do? Do you want to be, like, a system administrator for server-class machines where you're working on the back end for a company that has their own mail server and their own web server?
I did think about that. I have thought about that.
Well, I mean, you kind of, with this, you have to think about it, and then you have to kind of make a decision because there are so many different paths you could go on from here. You know, right now you're working on hardware and you're building hardware. You probably have some skills and some basic troubleshooting, so maybe moving over to a desktop support or technical support position would benefit you. That would get you into maybe another company where, like, for example, where I work, you know, you have the desktop support people and you've got the network engineers and you got the server administrators all kind of in this one area of our floor. So if one person who knows one skill wants to go and talk, you know, maybe go to lunch and see how things are done, or wants to go to the data center and change backup tapes or see what it's like to update a server, then get an idea of what that's like. They can see it firsthand. Thinking about it in the abstract and thinking, well, I want to be in computers. What do I want to do? It's a little tougher to say which way to go. You can go get all the certifications you want. Won't necessarily get you the job.
Yeah, experience is a critical piece, and just certifications without some kind of real hands-on is not high value. And so being in a place like Jay was describing is kind of the perfect thing.
There's certain areas where having certifications does have value even without experience, as far as getting a job. Like being a sysadmin, not so much. Even Windows or Red Hat or whatever. But like with Cisco, if you have Cisco certifications, like they actually have some value that you had to go to class, you had to take tests, you've actually proven that you have some level of knowledge enough at least to be like entry level to work on like in a networking environment. And I think that's probably a fairly stable field, at least for a while.
Well, that's a lot of knowledge though with that. I mean, you've got to know networking pretty much from the ground up. There are a lot of things that they're just going to assume you already know. Being able to work through the command line, you know, how different interfaces work, and then you've got to add a lot of knowledge on top of that.
But if you start from the beginning with the classes, I mean, they work you up through all that. I mean, I've talked to people who really don't know much about OSs that had gone through the Cisco classes and actually knew like Cisco command line level, like network, you know, network stuff, but weren't actually very, very good with like OSs.
The tough thing on any of this stuff is by the time if you're following some of it, is you probably want to look ahead and see, you know, Flick did mention that the Cisco thing is going to hold up for a long time. On a lot of stuff, it's going to keep changing, and you want to look ahead and build your skill set up so that when the demand happens for it,
yeah,
you're
stuff,
ready.
Yeah, stuff slides. I mean, I think something that's pretty stable to me, at least for a while, should be like networking, like specifically Cisco, just because they're a big company. They own a lot of the infrastructure of a lot of the big Fortune companies and stuff. They use their hardware. Another one is like SAP financial kind of stuff. Like those people are going to be around because it involves HR and accounting and all that stuff. But that's the specialization, and you have to figure out some way to get into that fold to start to get that experience.
Well, like SAP, it seems like people stumble into that one by being at a company that says, okay, we're going to go SAP, and they learn it because they went into
it. The project never ends. See, one thing that I would do is right now, it's the first of the year, you're going to see a lot of like job salary things coming out. Like Gartner's going to do some, Information World is going to do some, and they'll actually, you know, they'll do like, hey, what are the hot new jobs of the next 2 years, or what's going on? So just like Peter said, you know, it's like you can get a Novell certification, but that's going to take you nowhere right now. What you want to do is, yeah.
because it's going to take, you know, a year or so to get proficient in the field you want to move into. What you need to do is you need to find one of those that are up and coming. So when you get out of there, you're going to be one of those hot technologies that people want to hire for.
Virtualization is still growing a lot. I mean, it's already hot. It's not up and coming. It's here.
No,
it's,
but there's a lot of growth there.
But there's a lot of stuff still to be virtualized. So like VMware, stuff like that is like enterprise level virtualization. And I think if you can get into like big side storage, that's going to be huge, because there's always more and more data being created. Nobody's throwing anything away at all. Nobody's purging data. And so like large frame storage, like Hitachi backend stuff, NetApp stuff, that's going to be a field, because that everybody's storing data and they're just having to buy more and more stuff to store more and more data.
That's not a bad path, because once you get into that, you get into what's called big data, and that's how do you actually go through that much data and make sense of it. You know, how do you look at like trends? How do you, you know, business analytics and stuff like that? So that could be a springboard into a full-on career. Like that. But that's what I would do. Go pick out a specific area you like and then go see what certifications are available in that field.
Okay, so storage and Cisco. Okay, all right, that sounds cool. And I also had one more question. How do I listen to you guys on my phone?
What kind of phone do you have?
It's an Android S3.
Android, if you want to listen live, or do you want to listen later, podcast form?
Live.
Live, there's a radio app that will allow you to pick up the stream on Android. I can't remember what it's called.
I think MX Radio is what I use.
MX Radio?
MX Radio, okay.
Yeah, it's an app, and it allows you to call up the radio. You know, it connects to the streams, the live streams of numerous online radio. And we're in there.
Okay, MX Radio. Okay, I'll do that. Thank you guys so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for your call.
Okay, bye-bye.
Before we take the next call, Barrett raised a really good point. And it's the new year, so it's a good time to mention it to people. Because I just did a migration. Some people who had their own, they were running their own mail server. And the place they were at, some kind of flaky hosting place. Because their mails would suddenly, for long periods, weeks, get bounced because the IPs for the servers at this host were supposedly in the pool for residential, not business. And so their mail at the places that are really tight, like Hotmail and all that. Well, on top of that, so we moved them to the Google Mail, doing that for their hosting, which is pretty bulletproof and all that. Except, and this is what brings me to my point, the amount of mail, because people never throw out email anymore, they never go through it, the average person, if they've got a fairly busy inbox, has gigs and gigs of email. Sometimes, you know, I've actually run across a couple people where if they went to the Google Mail thing, it gives you 25 gigabytes, and the idea is that would keep everything you could possibly want. There are people I know who have enough mail that would not be enough.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not aware of a system that really handles that, unless you start to do like multiple local PST mailboxes or something like that. Like Exchange will go 25. They'll let you go over 25, but officially they don't want you to
and
go over 25.
And then to find the stuff. My suggestion, you know what I do, is basically I'll take and go back about 18 months. And then, unless I can see a reason why I should keep it, it's a wholesale, just either delete it, or you can archive it if you really want to be able to search it. But I've found that it's better to just let it, you know, it's kind of like your closet. You know, you move the shirts that you never wear over to another hanger or to the other side. And if you never took it off there in a year, you don't need it. Throw it out.
I will say that's one area I think that the job market is probably not going to be continuing growing. I think for a long time, mail was a specialization that a lot of people did, whether it was Exchange or whatever, Lotus or whatever in the back end. And that seems to be pretty close to being a commodity item now. Like people don't, I mean, there are still certain companies that need specialization with mail, but it's very, very easy now, Office 365 and Google and some other places, to set up your own MX records, do administration through them. I mean, they've taken a lot, especially from the, like, the small to medium businesses. They've taken a lot of that. They don't need somebody that has a specialization in exchange or whatever.
Unfortunately, they never fixed email as something that has been in need of being fixed. The protocol and how the servers work and all of that has been in need of being fixed for at least the past decade. And they've never, none of the big players have ever stepped up and fixed it. Because, of course, they could have fleets of people to manage that. And so it keeps compressing down to where, you know, it's going to be Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, and a few others running most of the mail. Because at a certain point, it gets to be where the pain in the rear end factor gets too big to have to mess with it to get your stuff to work. Because when your clients start getting bounces from Yahoo, because the big ones like that are really getting tight on anti-spam. And so if anything that was anywhere near the IP of your box was spam once.
And a lot of that is protocol. That's the SMBB protocol. I mean, and you can't get around it very easily. I mean, they've developed some stuff, but
well, they never reworked it to secure it so that when you sent an email, what I hate is, and anybody who runs their own domain has probably seen this, when you start getting a bunch of bounces from fake addresses on your domain, you know, so it's, you know, blah, 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 77433.
I've been getting a lot of those lately on my domains. This seems to be almost a relatively new one where you've got the random set of characters, alphanumeric characters, at your domain,
and you look, and in the headers that it sends, if you're geeky enough, you go read the headers on emails when you get that stuff, and it says, you know, that it was received from your server name, myserver.com, and then it shows the IP address that it had, and it ain't the one for your server, and they've never done anything to secure that.
There's no way to get around that. I mean, they have
DNS is broken too.
Well, they have SPF records, right? You can put out an SPF record, but that's still opt-in. If you don't. If whoever's receiving your mail doesn't look at SPF records and they're not strict about it, that doesn't matter because it's opt-in. And the other thing is that when you're setting that up, you can kind of control that from your side, but that's an option that a lot of email systems don't have because you have to have control of your outbound gateway and you have to be able to say all email that bounces back will have gone through this gateway, and then you have the gateway keep hash records of every email that went out, so when a bounce comes back, it can look against the hash to see if it's a bounce of an email that went out, and if it doesn't, then it drops it. But that's not something that's commodity, that's common, that most people are going to have access to.
Right, and you've got these people out there. There are the places out there where they're blocking your domain because spam came from it, and it never went near your server. It never was on you. And
that's the real problem. See, we haven't actually just dealt with spam. We haven't just like killed spammers.
Well, it's as easy to fake your address. You know, we've told people before. Easy to fake your address on an email as it is to fake it on an envelope where you can write the return address.
Although it's easier to get blocked now than it used to be. Just free for all. I mean, anybody could fake it and nobody stopped it, and it was just up to the person that received it to decide if it was or not. And they've put all these things in to try to deal with it, but the actual protocol itself isn't designed to stop that. I mean, you can't say, except with SPF records, and that's if the sender's domain has an SPF record and the receiver's domain looks at SPF records and is strict on enforcing them. There's no way to know that. But what we deal with a lot of times, like where I work, because I work with Mailflow a lot, is legitimate accounts that are compromised, you know? So in that case, the SPF records, everything's going to be fine because it's a legitimate email from a legitimate domain.
That's why I always look at them. That's why I read the headers on them, is I'm always making sure that somebody hasn't
hacked one of my customers
hasn't been compromised, that it's really, that it's not from them. But
all right. Great conversation. Hate computers.
Hey, if they all worked perfectly all the time, everybody
should definitely stay out of the field.
Well, I mean, it's like I've been at the company I'm at, my employer, so long now that there are certain people that have also been there a long time that have these ridiculous mail situations where they've got PST files scattered everywhere and they've got multiple copies of the same PST because they've migrated to new computers. And we don't have any place to, you know, you can't store it on their computer because if they lose their computer, they lose all their email database. We can't store it on the server because the server's crashing from having gigs and gigs in each person's mail store. So every once in a while, it'll come up where some old timer has either, you know, quit, moved to another job, or gotten fired, or whatever. He's like, whew, don't have to deal with that mail anymore.
Well, that, and there, you know, there's something to look at for somebody if you're looking for an area to work in. Email, the email clients aren't really set up to deal with the kind of mass email. They start flaking out.
Well, we've,
and there's no, and for archiving it, nobody's really come up with a system to where you can, even though they're just freaking files.
The archiving
system. They should be able
to
go into a database or something that was searchable.
No, we've done that too. Every archiving system I've played with and looked at and that has been implemented where I work is not pretty because it just, they're trying to build some solution that's going to work with like all these mail clients, and they can't do it. And so they pick their flavor of mail clients, which usually is Outlook. That's what it works pretty well with. But once you get outside of Outlook, everything starts getting flaky really fast, you know. And so you end up with 10 to 15% depending on. Now, if you have a corporate office and you can completely lock it down, then you can say no. This is the mail client you use. So, yeah, the archiving system works fine. But if you're in a more free format, then it doesn't work very well.
With doing contract stuff and all of that, then I've been at several different, you know, major, you know, Fortune 500-type places. And most of the time their deal is there's no real archiving. You've reached the limit of your mailbox. It deletes something.
See, that's
it depends on the company's policy on whether or not they have to retain all of the email or not. And I know my company ultimately does retain all of the email, whether you like it or not. But it's also up to the user to manage their mail stores. You know, they can delete after a while, but some people use their mail as an archive system where they just,
right.
You know, I've got all my templates stored, so I search for this one and I find my, you know, and they've got, not only have they got the email, but they've got the attachment.
Yeah, my 17 collaborators around the world trade these Word docs multiple times a day, and I've got every revision stored in my email system going back for 2 years.
Right. It's, you know,
there are no good archiving solutions either, especially given how generic email really is at the heart of it. But then you add attachments, so then you've got binaries, and it just
and then they try to do dedupes, and I mean it.
Mm-hmm. Sales uses like 50% of our storage, and they're like 3% of our employees, just because they're, you know, like these 20 meg PST files.
Yeah, here,
sorry, 20 meg, yeah, the PowerPoint files. It's like just
that's right. Here's my revisions on the PowerPoint you sent me.
Yeah,
4 or 5 times within 20 minutes. You know,
it's good Lord. You know, we've got really good file share set up where people can like
they don't use them.
Drop a file in there.
No, they
pass
a lot of people just view email as another file cabinet retention spot.
Well, it used to be, you know, that's the problem. See, we need to like go on a bandwidth reduction movement.
And enforce, strip everything out that's more than, you don't need more than 50K for an email. If you have more than that to say.
We're going
to
throttle you. We're going to throttle your LAN down to where if you plug in a 10 meg attachment, your computer is going to just grind to a halt while it tries to shove that through the Ethernet.
Make all the salespeople use Twitter.
Dial up.
You know what?
Share Twitter.
You know what made it even worse? Top posting. Top replying, I think. I hate top reply. I do it now sometimes because everybody does it now, but I hate that. And because the thing is, you hit reply, and they don't look at anything. They just hit reply and type a message and hit send. Well, this thing may have like 7,000 lines of completely irrelevant stuff that they never even scroll down to look at. And so that's increasing the size of every email reply because they're just replying.
I'm a top replier. I prefer that method of replying.
Yeah, see, I started earlier with email, and so my is to step through the email reply in line or at the bottom.
What I hate, junk, what I really don't like stuff. Is like there'll be a group of people having an ongoing reply to all discussion, and then somebody will say, I'm going to loop Jay in. And it's like, JC below. Ah!
Oh. Yeah.
You're like, what am I looking for? Good God. All right, let's take some calls on this before we just get on the group. Do you have anything that you're particularly upset with?
40 signatures by the same person that's like 20 lines long.
I love it when they're actually image files, so you've got like 2 megs of just, you know, image signatures writing along.
Of the same image, yeah, and it's like, you know, how can we give you a great service today?
Oh, blah, 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 blah. Better than that, though, is when they forward it and they... When the way they forward it does not include the attachment, so you get it, and it's got five people who've been talking about this attachment.
But you're getting the reply that doesn't have
one. And you see the thing that says, you know, my attachment.doc with the little carrots next to it where it belongs, but there's no file there anymore. It got stripped out somewhere on the forwards. Anyway.
713-526-5738. Groovehouse.
Poor Groovehouse. Yep. He doesn't have enough complaints.
Well, do we have a call, or did you want to gripe about something?
Oh, no, we've got calls.
If you want to gripe, I want you to feel like you could be included in this. I mean,
no
do
gripes.
You, he works IT in a granola situation, so it's all
very crunchy.
Everybody's peaceful, and hey, man,
most of them don't like computers, so they don't use them.
I love Windows.
They probably ask, did you use hemp with that? they go off, and they don't bother them for a long time.
We all reply above. Everybody does.
We'll reply any way you want, man. I print my email and I walk into the desk and I go, I want to respond to this.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I know somebody that.
Can I get this copied out in henna?
Oh, he's got to have a hard copy of everything.
Oh yeah, there's people that that cut out my newspaper column and stave them in folders.
Yeah.
All right.
Future hoarders of America.
Groovehouse, who's up?
All right, up next on the show, we're going to speak with Scooter.
Scooter.
Hey, guys.
Wow, I was just thinking I hadn't heard from Scooter in a while.
This is the first Wednesday night off since I got System 7 a year ago. So, anyway, I have a... by the way, I really enjoyed the first 30 minutes of Philip K. Dick at the top of the show. It's awesome. but that's not why I called. I have a really specific question, so I'm going to ask it in real specific terms so we don't get lost in this. I have Windows 7, and I have a window open on the screen. The window open on my screen is all MP3s that I create because, you know, doing radio, they're not downloaded.
Uh-huh.
And the details that they offer me are name, tic-tac-toe thing, title, contributing artists, and albums, none of which this has anything to do with the way that I want to look at them, which is like details, date created, the original sort of...
Right, record. You just want to see the file information. Yeah.
I don't know how to change that.
It's showing it to you as a... Have you got your radio turned down, Scooter? You of all people who do radio...
No, I do have my radio tone.
Okay,
down.
I'm hearing a weird lag.
Your phone must be echoing.
I'm on an iPhone, so.
All right, there is, the folder identifies them as music files, so it is giving you that kind of information based on the fact that it sees it as a music file. I would imagine that if you, I don't have a Windows 7 computer in front of me, but I think if you alt view, you should be able to choose a different list.
No, I googled the crap out of this and gone through it. Believe me, I'm genuinely stumped. And if Technology Bites gave an artificial award for artificial intelligence, I think I'm trumping the autoplay on this.
Okay. Let's see.
But it's so basic. When you Google it, all of the terms that you use are so often used that you can't get an answer to your question. So maybe this may be in a Douglas Adams sort of way, the question that's so dumb that you can't answer it. That's my challenge.
Let's see. Now all of these MP3 files, are they saved in a folder that you created, or are they saved in your My Documents, My Music folder?
No. It's, yeah. Totally,
no. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, so you've created this folder. It's not like Windows 7. It's music folder. Says I'm going to show you this.
No, none of that. And the thing is that when you get like let's say if you have 10 MP3s in a folder and then maybe 3 or 4 other text things, it'll immediately change it into like iTunes. Like it thinks it's iTunes. It's bizarre.
Well, that's a file association thing, right?
Right.
Because it's seeing it as an MP3 file. It's saying that's associated with iTunes.
Right. No. It just thinks it's iTunes. It's pretending to be iTunes when you get too many MP3s in a folder in Windows 7. In other words, it wants to think for you. So, and I can't figure out how to get around it. It's bizarre. I can't figure out how to create my own details in my own directory in my own file that I created.
Can you right-click up at the top on any of those items and customize that list where you can actually choose what you want it to show you? Can you add? Because, you know, you can add top-level things on your folders, right?
No.
Yes, you can.
Okay, tell me how.
If you go up to the top where, okay, for right now, you got a music folder open, right?
Yes.
So you got your file on the left-hand side, and you've got these different columns that say, for right now, it says, artist, whatever, and so
forth, right?
If you right-click on where it says artist, is there an option to customize view or add a column?
Oh, dude, that was it. I knew you got me. It was not the question too dumb to answer. Thank you.
So we solved it?
That's it, yeah.
All right.
Bye. Thanks, guys.
Sure.
All right.
I'm happy again.
Jay throws the Hail Mary, and it's in the end zone.
I'm sorry. He made it sound like it was harder than it was. All right. There you go. 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air with us. Groovehouse is screening calls, and as a call screener, he has screened 3 calls.
Yes, I have.
And they are waiting.
Yes, they are.
And who's the first to go on the air with us?
First to go on the air is going to be Derek.
Derek, you're on the air with Technology Bites. What can we do for you?
Hey, fellas, I have a problem here. I had bought a refurbished laptop. It's an old Toshiba. And what is going on with it is when we just recently had like an update from Windows and clicked on it. It went through the update perfectly, but then when I cut it off and then cut it back on, nothing but a blank screen come up in just a little faint blip light. And that's it.
So you ran your updates.
Yes.
And you rebooted the computer, and what are you seeing now?
It's a black screen, but it just has the little blinking light.
Okay, so where did you get the computer from when you say it's refurbished?
Laptop Warehouse.
How long ago did you get it?
At January.
January? Oh.
Last year.
Oh, last year. Okay. Well, when you ran the update, it made some modifications to the system, and now it's not fully loading the operating system.
Okay.
And that could be caused by either corrupted software or maybe some change that the update tried to run. What you can do is there's a way to start the computer in what's called safe mode.
Okay.
And what you do is you turn the computer off, hold the power button down until the computer completely shuts off.
Okay.
And then turn it back on. And while it's coming back up, if you press the F8 key before it tries to load Windows, it should bring up a menu that gives you some options. And one of them is you can restore it to an earlier point, so you can try to back out of that. Uh-huh. Or you could try to bring it up in safe mode and see if it'll load up. If it'll load up in safe mode, sometimes you can reboot it after that and it'll load normally.
Okay, I'm doing it as you speak, and all I'm getting is just the same thing. But what it is, it's just constantly beeping now.
Oh, so press the power button down until the computer completely shuts down, until all the lights are off. That might be 5 seconds or 10 seconds.
Right, it's all the way off.
All right, so now when you press the power button, what's happening?
It's just, it's coming on. It's showing a little front
Hit the F8 key a couple of times.
Okay.
And see if you can get in, see if we can interrupt the boot process here. Not real fast. Don't machine gun it. Just slightly tap F8.
Gotcha.
And see if it'll bring it up to safe mode. Are you getting anything?
No, it's still a little blinking light. But if I turn it off and then press F12, something comes up.
Tell you what, it sounds to me like this is going to be beyond our ability to really troubleshoot on the air. You're going to want to have somebody have a look at it. Maybe the place that you bought it from could have a look and see if they can determine what's going on.
Well, you know what? I took it to that rascal, and he said that it seems to be a software problem.
Well, when you bought the computer from him, did he give you the software to be able to reload? No.
No.
That's too bad, because really, you know, when you buy a computer, even if you buy it brand new from somebody, something could go wrong with the software, and you need to have the disk to be able to reload the computer, put the software back on it.
Right.
So if he didn't give you that, or give you the ability to make that when he sold you the computer, then he didn't do very good by you.
Yes, that's what I'm gathering. Well, at least now people on the radio knows.
All right. Well, sorry I couldn't help you more. Good luck.
Thank you, man.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye. You know, that's one of the things, you know, if you think you're getting a good deal on a computer, if you're not terribly technically savvy, you can really be taken advantage of by some of these refurbished shops, these places that say, you know, you see them when you go down Westheimer sometimes, it's like laptops, $100 or something.
Yeah, that's what this place was. It was like stuff starting out from like $120 with a free laptop case and all this other stuff, but no mention of actual operating system or like legally disks that you now own when you buy that.
Well, if you're looking for a good deal on a used computer with some kind of integrity behind it, I would say check out the Goodwill computer store over. They do a good job. They sell for a reasonable price. They check the systems out, and they'll stand
that's
by.
That's pretty far out on Westheimer, right? Like Derry Ashford or
something? Yeah, it's out towards Derry Ashford, just outside the Beltway on Westheimer, but it's called Computer Works.
HoustonComputerWorks.org if you're looking for the site.
And we've talked to them on the air before. They do a pretty good job, and I think they'll give, you know, they load it up with a copy of the operating system, and they'll give you I think they'll give you the disk that they use, or tell you what you need to do to make one. But a lot of times bargain computers are not a bargain.
Yeah, other than someplace like that where you know you can trust them, you want to buy something that's either new or refurbished that's from the manufacturer. If you go to any of the major manufacturers, their online store will have
refurbs,
or if you go to a place like Fry's or Micro Center, they sometimes have that stuff. And that's a new machine that should have it, or it's for
treated
your purposes,
as new,
like new, and it has all the stuff like new, where even at some of these shops where they say it's refurbished, they're trying to make it sound like that it is the same as
all
new.
They did was
it's
they
a
got
used,
it.
It's a used car.
It's a used car, exactly right. They got it. They ran a vacuum on it. They shook out the spiders, and they got it to where it would boot, and then they sell it to you. It's not
and
like
the, and then the OS reload. That's the clean car smell.
All right, 713-526-573. I got about 15 minutes left worth of on air. Talking to callers, kind of time left, so got two calls in the queue. We probably get another one or two in if you want to try. 713-526-5738. Groove House.
Yes.
Who's up?
Up next, we're going to speak with Bruce.
Bruce, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know how you guys were kind of prognosticating at the beginning of the show about the future and how the 1% and their machine minions were going to control everything and all that?
Yeah, well, it was.
Yeah, well, that's kind of a rough summary.
well, there's a really good report. It's called Global Trends 2030, and it's published by the National Intelligence Council, and it's really good. It's really good reading. our tax dollars went into it. And if you look that over, I think it will ease your worries some. Basically,
well, just kind of
basically, there's three apocalypses and a zombie uprising in between now and when anything else happens.
No, actually, it says the majority of the world's people are going to be middle class by 2030. Economic center of gravity is going to be Asia. Europe will be the economic backwaters, kind of like the situation was around the year 1500.
Fish will be getting back together.
You know, non-state actors will be a lot more important. And it says the U.S., if we have a future, it's going to be kind of manipulating these other people, kind of gathering up whoever's most successful at gathering up coalitions will have the most power.
All right. Well, it looks interesting. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence, or the DNI.gov, and if you Google search what he just said, the 2030.
Global Trends 2030.
Global Trends 2030, and there it is.
Cool.
All right.
Really good.
Appreciate the tip.
Okay.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
Did he say anything about robotics?
What would be the middle class, though? That's you know, to say the majority would be middle class. Like, so everybody makes, you know, middle class for their country. So in this country, the middle class is, you know, $9,000
US a
year.
I would hope it means sort of the thing where you've got, where there's sort of a certain minimum of things. You know, you have a TV and
a roof.
The report doesn't say how much.
Water, you know, clean water and
shelter.
That kind of stuff. By 2030.
It doesn't say how much robot polishes are going to be making in 2030, sadly. They left that part out.
All right. 713-526-5738. Groove House.
Yes.
What?
I was thinking of the Road Warrior.
You were?
Oh, yeah. The Road apocalyptic visions. 3 days ago, I saw a trailer that could haul this tanker. If you want to get out of here, you talk to me.
All right, well, I'm ready to saw my hand
where
off.
Where are our gyrocopters, as promised in the Road Warrior?
Yeah, we'll all get stuck with Feral Kids.
John Feral's kids?
Who?
All right, Grimas, who's up?
All right, up next on the show, we're going to speak with Jason.
Jason, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hey, guys, thanks a lot. This week, I decided I wanted to ditch my CRT monitor I've had for going on 15 years and upgrade to an LED. Walking through Micro Center, I saw some I didn't really like. I realized I like regular LED better than backlit LED, if that makes sense. And one brand I saw that I didn't recognize at all was AOC. And I was curious if you guys had any experience with their products and if they can stand behind their stuff.
I've had a couple of AOC monitors. I mean, their prices are usually pretty low. The first one that I bought was a like floor display model at a place that was like heavily discounted, and so I bought it and the extended warranty thing for less than a new one. Yeah. The thing is, I've never had to use it.
27 inch IPS monitor for under $400.
Yeah,
and then the lower, like the 20 inch, 24 inch, they're in the lower for a brand new monitor. They're in the lower, you know, like lower $100, $150.
119 for like a 23.6 or something. It looked really good. I mean, really good.
I think it's pretty hard to find somebody that's going to have a just totally unreliable and horrible LCD monitor anymore.
I would imagine that when you're dealing with budget monitors that, you know, it depends on what you're using it for. If you were, like, say, a graphic artist or you're doing a lot of photo and video editing, the dead pixels could present some kind of problem, because you'll probably have, you know, all monitors sometimes they'll have dead pixels or they'll have problems with contrast or something weird. But for just general computer use for browsing the web, doing email, and, you know, maybe looking at pictures and videos and stuff, as a consumer, a budget monitor shouldn't be a problem. I've got a a Westinghouse that I picked up that on a closeout, and it's great. It was cheap, and it's nothing terribly spectacular, but it's got...
And oddly, that's probably a more obscure manufacturer. Westinghouse, they bought the name. China bought the name.
Well, AOC, it looks like, I know there's just a handful of people that actually make, like, the panels. Like, Samsung, I know, makes some, I think. I don't know who else. There's Sharp, a couple others. Sharp. AOC, it looks like, they were one of the panel makers. They supplied ViewSonic for years, and it looks like they're kind of coming out not to compete with ViewSonic in the higher-end, like, graphic displays, but they're dumping their own panels and monitors. So it looks like it's probably a good deal. It looks like they're the same flat panels that would come with the ViewSonic monitor.
Oh,
they're
good.
just now getting out there in the consumer realm, like LG coming out of nowhere, you know, one of those kind of things.
My TV is LG, and I never heard of them before. It's great. It's
just, Yeah. Hey, good.
So,
sounds like there's no red flags that any
and if
of us
you buy it from a place like, you know, buy it, if it has a year warranty, I mean, you know, and if you buy it from a place like Best Buy or something that offers an extended warranty, if you're concerned about it, pick up the extended warranty. And
I think Micro Center offers a 3-year or a 1-year limited or a 3-year
on a price point like that. It shouldn't be terribly expensive for that warranty either.
Exactly. Okay, good. Well, I'm happy about that. Thanks a lot, guys.
All right, well, good luck. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, the IPS Jay mentioned, that's kind of the new big thing. That's getting a much higher quality look and color without having to get up into the, you know, $1,000, $1,200 Apple high-end Dell range.
Although I am seriously eyeballing that 27-inch Apple monitor.
I bought one a couple of months ago.
All right, here's a question, since we have no calls and we got a little bit of time to kill.
I have a question, too, then.
Okay, well, let me ask this question here. Maybe you would know the answer, Flicked it or Pete.
Yes, now my question.
Fine. I've lost control of my own show, so it doesn't matter. No, the 27-inch Thunderbolt monitor from Apple, is it the same monitor, spec for spec, as the monitor that's included with the new 27-inch iMac?
I don't know.
I would think they've got to be pretty similar. I think that
assume so, though, because Apple stopped making like freestanding monitors. They only make 27 now. In the store, like all you can buy is 27.
I would bet it's the same general tech inside. They've
gone for cost decreases by numbers, and so it's probably just stamping them all out.
Okay, and then
that was my guess.
A sub question to that is, why is the Mac Mini not as powerful as the iMac in terms of computing power?
I think that's just because they don't want the iMac Mini to be too successful.
If you look at it the way, you know, it seems to me, if you start looking at the price points and stuff, that then the if you put together the monitor and a Mac Mini, it always ends up costing more than a 27-inch iMac.
But the Mac Mini,
you add the two together.
Yeah, but the Mac. Well, no, the Mac Mini is
and they always and keep the processor lower.
Well, yeah. Right. No, the Mac Mini is cheaper. If you buy a Mac Mini and a 27-inch Apple monitor, it's cheaper than a 27-inch iMac. But you cannot get the Mac Mini up to the same specs in terms of
they're not offering the SSD stuff, or well, maybe they are now, but they're not offering the same
processor. They're not offering the i7.
Yeah.
It's only an i5, and it's like
they're trying to have it be a gateway machine.
Yeah, I think it's intentional.
Which I don't know. At some point, maybe they're going to wake up and break with that idea. But as long as the iMac is making them tons of dough, I think they're
because the Power Mac prices are crazy.
They're insane.
Yeah, and that's where they put the good the good hardware. But they're expensive. So it's like the Mac Mini. They kind of give you the low end with the Mac Mini. They give you the middle with the iMac, and they give you the high end with the Power Mac.
Although the iMac rivals the thing is, the iMac is really encroaching heavily on the Power Mac, on the big desktop for performance. That there's been a long time where the high end 27-inch for the price difference is so close that it makes you wonder why, other than if you really needed the slots and stuff, why you
see. I was happy on this last revision of the Mac Mini that they finally bumped up the memory specs, so now you can put 16 gig in it. So that's
well,
that's
and they made it so it was possible without a like with like a rubber. Or with,
which one is this?
A spackling.
The latest Mac Mini, the late 2012 Mac Mini. You can put 16 gig of memory in it now, which is what mine has now.
Nice.
I think if the iMac ever started really falling off in sales, that then they might bump the Mini up. But I think it's more of, I think that's their idea. It's their gateway for people who are choosing between a PC and Macs.
It's like a gateway because they've already got a monitor and a keyboard and a mouse, and
it's
just replace the component.
Well, no, I mean,
consider a Hackintosh, because basically for about a grand, you could build yourself the equivalent of a $4,000 Mac Pro, the big desktop.
The silver one.
Lifehacker has an article, you can go read it on it, that basically takes like the basic desktop Mac, and then the like seriously upgraded, and then the like crazy everything in it one, the $8,000 one, and you can match the features in that if you're comfortable building your own computer and managing it yourself like that, which obviously, you know, you fit in that audience like me and most of the rest of us on here. And it was like $1,800 or $2,200. So you're saving $5,000 versus the like top of the line Ultra. And that's real close. You know, obviously first you have to get the monitor.
Yeah.
And so that first go round, basically you would be spending for the Hackintosh and the screen, you'd be spending about the same amount as buying a really loaded 27-inch iMac. But then the next one, if you build a new one and replace it and use the same screen, now you saved a bunch of money the second time.
Right, but I think on the 27-inch iMac, you can use that as just a monitor down the road. As was the prop, though, where I went wrong with my Mac. I want to make sure that Flicky gets to ask his question.
My question was just, I was wondering if anybody's looked at and bought a printer recently. Specifically,
I have.
Color LaserJet.
Not a Color Laser. I bought one of the new HP Color Inkjets.
Oh, no. I had a Color LaserJet. I bought it like a number of years ago. It's acting weird now. It's a hardware issue. And I want to buy another one, but I haven't looked at them in a long time, so I don't really know price points and expectations.
When I went to go buy this printer, I looked at the LaserJet's color, and really there was just no reason to get one. I mean, the inkjets are so good right now.
Has the price per page gone down a lot?
It's come down quite a bit.
Because the ink was it was stupid for me because I'd buy the ink cartridges and I wouldn't use it for 30 days, and they'd be dried up, and I'd go have to buy another ones, and they were just as much as the printer cost. So.
Well, this new HP, I haven't had to replace the cartridges, but just based, you know, I had a Color inkjet that was about 5 years old, 6 years old, and it had the cartridges. You would go to print something, you didn't print something for a month, and it would print, and part of the color would be missing. So you have to run this clean on it. This other one, this HP I got, it's wireless, it goes into standby mode, and I send a job to it, it comes out, it looks just fantastic.
So to go opposite the robot thing, instead of getting a Color laser printer or whatever, I've just got a factory full of Chinese kids standing by.
Well, they
color anything that I want. They usually stay in the lines. But.
I just say go and take a look at it. But what I saw was I was not going to, for the amount of printing that I do anyway, I wasn't going to save any money, really, going with a LaserJet. But, I don't know. All right, well, the first show of 2013 is in the can.
We successfully ended without being replaced by robots.
Well, you know, tune in next week to see if we are replaced by robots.
We're going to try and do it gradually, though, so you'll have to guess. it's like Survivor, but
Battlestar Galactica.
Well, you were a lot more robotic when you were coming in on Skype.
Maybe he's showing up just to throw us off the robot trail. That's what's going on.
No,
I'm just a brain in a jar.
Well, we got to get out of here. So, you've been listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicked.
I'm Barrett.
And he's
Geek Gathering Friday.
Oh, yeah, Geek Gathering Friday. Be there and be square. Go to geekradio.com for details.
Starting later in January, KPFT embarks on its winter fund drive. Visit kpft.org now to make a pre-pledge to your favorite shows. Your pre-drive support could trim hours and even days off of the upcoming marathon before it even starts. That's right. Contribute now at kpft.org to support your favorite programming and reduce our winter drive. You can pledge creatively, offer a matching fund, become a sustainer, or get some great thank you gifts. Your support right now helps shorten those long fund drive days. Again, that's kpft.org to pre-pledge securely online toward our upcoming fund drive. Keep up with updates at facebook.com and, if you can, help out at our pledge center. Stay tuned for training dates and more. Go to kpft.org to pre-pledge now. KPFT Houston.
KPFT is supported in part by Houston's Art Alliance and PowerToGive.org, Houston's funding platform for local arts organizations. PowerToGive.org empowers donors to give directly to local arts and cultural projects that inspire them. Nonprofit organizations post projects that are in need of funding. The community helps bring them to life with gifts. PowerToGive.org is a fun and easy way to support Houston's arts. For more information,